This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of a four-part mini-series of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where EFL department leads provide a unique insight into the workings of the organisation and explain some of the key roles and functions of the world's original league competition. What is it the Football League does? How do they do it? And why? Inside the walls of the EFL on this mini-series edition of the official EFL podcast. So on this particular episode, we are talking about plotting a sustainable future for EFL clubs. We're going to do it in the company of EFL's chief executive, Trevor Birch. And I guess a good starting point, Trevor, would be, bearing in mind you've spent your entire professional life, if we include your playing career, in football. I mean, just how tough has the last 18 months been?
I think it's been amazingly tough, Clem, and it's probably unprecedented. I mean, that word has been used many times, but I think its use is appropriate here for clubs to play effectively behind closed doors for a good season and a half nearly has been profound. And, you know, all credit has got to go to the clubs for getting through that period. You know, if you'd have said at the start of the last season, for example, that we'd play all but two of the games behind closed doors, I'm not sure many people would have fancied our chances of getting through the season intact. But we did, and it's a credit to all concerned.
Even with all your personal experiences, working with a couple of the major global accountancy firms, being involved with the sale of Chelsea to Roman Abramovich, Portsmouth's administration, there have been things in your 6 months in the chief exec's job at the EFL that have just caused you to go, blimey, I never in a million years expected to encounter this. How on earth am I going to deal with this?
I think you deal with the problems in front of you, don't you, Clem? So they're all different and all seem insurmountable at first, but then if you deal with them logically and one by one, then at least it becomes a little bit more achievable. There have been occasions and when you thought this is an impossible situation, particularly when, for example, January, when we were looking at a whole host of positive tests, weren't we? Were a lot of games being postponed, and the thought, you know, surely we won't be able to fit all these games in before the end of the season. But then the use of the protocols and the adherence to the protocols enabled those positive tests to drop right down almost to zero. And again, that's testament to the club's discipline in adhering to those protocols, so managed to keep people in bubbles and enabled us to get through the season. We then had the prospect of potentially a financial meltdown, but by a number of assistances, we were able to get through, with help from the Premier League in terms of some of those monitored loans, in terms of the iFollow revenues that were generated, season ticket holders not requesting refunds. You know, there was a whole host of support measures that were put in place to help the clubs get through.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the sort of protocols, because I think that's an important point. I think there was a sort of focus, wasn't there, on the quarter of £1 billion collective loss in gate receipts. But for clubs to have been able to put games on throughout all this, to as safely as possible get those that were necessary to make football happen into stadiums, out again, the controls around training grounds, quite breathtaking, actually.
Well, it is. It's, you know, potentially a logistical nightmare. And when you look at the detail that the protocols went into, I mean, and if you'd attended those games on match days and seen the, you know, the strict protocols and adherence to them by everybody. It's just been a remarkable achievement, Clem, I think, for clubs to have got through it. Really, yeah. Is. And they've been so detailed. You can only applaud them, really.
Yeah. I wonder whether we need to pay tribute to the EFL's main broadcast partner as well, Sky,
Trevor, because arguably the rebate that might have been expected to have been paid for curtailment, not the season that's just finished, but the back end of the one before, was arguably smaller than you might have initially feared. And also, they allowed you to be flexible to set up this the iFollow platform to cover all and stream all the matches that weren't being broadcast on Sky. So
you're right to mention it, Clem. You know, they've been a hugely supportive partner, and we're very grateful to them for enabling us to spread that rebate and for it to be at such a low level, and then to enable us to stream the games, which has been, you know, enabled clubs really to have a lifeblood for revenue generation for the rest of the season. As I say, either by protecting season ticket refunds or indeed in the match passes themselves. So, you know, huge thank you to Sky and indeed our other sponsors who have stood by us.
I'll tell you what as well, Trevor, comes to mind is just how important your clubs are. Well, footballers in general, but just how important your clubs have been to their respective communities too, because the level of support to people struggling, again, was quite breathtaking.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've been a vital lifeline of support, Clem, and through the community organisations. You know, what's been brought on by the pandemic in terms of food poverty, mental health, unemployment. You know, I think the community organisations have delivered 1.4 million food parcels, for example, and the number of calls that clubs have made as well to supporters in need. You know, I think that's over 500,000. And then we've got the job opportunities that the Kickstart programme has provided for young unemployed. Stadiums being used for mass vaccination and testing sites, you know, so they've played a vital part, Clem, and as I say, when clubs have been financially challenged as well, to provide that level of support has been amazing.
I want to put a lid on the past, so to speak, in a second, but you know, it's been so profound. When the pandemic first hit, so this is March 2020, had you moved to Spurs as director of football by then, or were you still in your role at Swansea?
I was at Swansea, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, could you quite believe it? Were you in the same position as everybody across society, just didn't believe that this could possibly paralyse the world like it has and bring us all to our knees?
No, well, we were due to play Middlesbrough away that weekend.
Always a tough fixture, if I may say
always
so.
A going tough
to the, always a tough one going to Middlesbrough. Just had to get that in there.
Thought you'd appreciate that one.
Yeah.
And it was, I think it was on the Friday, wasn't it, that was announced that there was a lockdown.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's incredulity, really, isn't it, to think that you could actually lock down the whole nation. And you just think, maybe, you know, if that had happened sort of 10, 15 years earlier, I'm not sure that they'd been able to lock down the nation with the advance in technology and the social video calls that have been able to be made. You know, without that technology, I don't think it would have been possible to do it, or it would have wreaked even more havoc. So then thinking, well, what would there be the impact on the game? You're obviously thinking, well, A, when will we be able to return? How are clubs going to be able to get through this pandemic? Particularly with, they've obviously still got a fixed cost base with player wages. And so the whole thoughts about, you know, the possibility of a huge number of clubs financially failing was a big prospect at that stage. So, you know, to have got through it without potentially losing any clubs has been amazing.
Yeah, well done to all. So how are we feeling? What's the mood heading into the next season, which as we record this is about a month away? How is everybody feeling and obviously anticipating the return to full stadiums, Trevor?
Well, yeah, I think after the Euro euphoria and England's success, I think we've seen the cathartic effect of football. So looking forward to the season is just one of excitement. You know, after the huge, challenging circumstances that we've had to endure.
Now, I read a piece that you wrote at the beginning of June. It was on the EFL Zone website, and the headline was, EFL model needs to be about sustainability, not sustainability, not philanthropy, needs to be about sustainability, not philanthropy, said at the 15th attempt. Hopefully producer Dave has helped me in the edit there. What do you mean, Trevor?
Well, I think clubs relying on the benefactor, we'll call it that, should we, Clem? That's maybe easier. Relying on the benefactor model, there is always the possibility that at some stage that tap is turned off. And we've seen that happen on a number of occasions. And when it's created an unsustainable cost base, clubs just then don't have the wherewithal to fill that revenue gap or funding gap, and have got into financial difficulties. Recent examples of Wigan and Bury, and probably Bolton as well in that respect, have shown that that is the case. So if we can move to a model where, you know, clubs' own generated funds allow the clubs to be sustainable and break even, then that should attract more people, more investors into the game. And in fact, opens it up to wider fan involvement in the game as well, because, you know, a supporter just can't afford to run clubs once a benefactor model has been broken, because it's left a legacy of liabilities, ongoing liabilities that they just can't afford to fund.
I mean, you've been very vocal about the gap between your clubs and the top end of the game. So is the EFL's chairman, Rick Parry. I mean, it just seems to be the two areas just seem to be getting further and further apart.
Yeah, and this is a direct result of the victims of their own success in terms of the Premier League has just accelerated away, and that chasm between the Premier League now and the Championship has grown probably disproportionately, Clem, and the parachute payments then that are given to those clubs who come into the Championship, again, are distorting the competition in the Championship, which have grown exponentially over the years. So now the parachute payments given to, say, the six or seven clubs at the moment in the Championship probably represent half the total revenues of the clubs within the Championship. So you can see, you know, 7 out of 24, it's a distorting effect on competition, which forces then the other clubs to compete at a level that is probably unsustainable. Well, is unsustainable, because we've got wage to turnover ratios of 107% with losses, you know, over 300 million.
Having said that, if I took you back to a year ago on the job that you were doing, and the situation that you took on in trying to stabilise Swansea City post dropping out of the Premier League, I guess that those Championship clubs would argue they're very, very necessary for us to be competitive in the Premier League, but to be able to try and keep our noses clean when we come down. We know why they were put there in the first place, so you've seen it from both sides.
Yeah, you can understand it, because obviously the Premier League want clubs coming into the Premier League to be competitive and would encourage clubs to, you know, to build a competitive squad, and the parachute payments are there to support them if relegated. But of course, in so doing, and as those parachute payments have grown in value disproportionately, as I say, to the revenue that's generated by the other clubs, it just hugely distorts the competition within the Championship to a level now where something probably needs to done to even up that cliff face from the drop from Premier League to Championship. So it's beholden on us both, really, Premier League and the EFL, to try and fix that and bridge that gap.
Yeah, I mean, just to underline that point, a club in the first year of parachute payments would receive £44 million. Other Championship clubs would receive about £5 million. That's one hell of a gap, Trevor.
Yeah, and as we've seen, it's grown over the years. And if you look at the seven clubs who are receiving those payments now in the Championship, you know, they're at 240 million, which is half the total revenues of the clubs. So trying to compete against those seven clubs forces the clubs to overspend. And as we've seen, you know, wage turnover ratios of 107%, and the difficulty in what it leaves then as a legacy is that benefactors, as we've talked about the benefactor model, just get a bit fed up if they don't achieve promotion, and therefore leave an unsustainable cost base for whoever follows. And clubs get into trouble. So that's the impact, if you like, in that distortion of competition.
Yeah, and practically, tangibly, clubs with parachute payments are twice as likely to be promoted back to the Premier League and considerably less likely to suffer relegation to the third tier. So if anybody's in any doubt about this and maybe doesn't understand the finances of the game, Trevor, it's staring them in the face in terms of what they see at the end of every football season.
Yeah, finance obviously matters, and it is a business now, and that gap has grown. If you look at the total revenue of the Premier League, which I think per season is what was just over 4.2 billion. I think it's reduced obviously in 2020, but the turnover of the Championship would be about 500 million. So you can see the distorting effect of that gap.
Yeah. I mean, this widening chasm between the leagues. In 1993, so the end of the first season of the Premier League, the Premier League's turnover was 45 million and the EFL's was 34 million. So what, a deficit of about a quarter for the EFL. By 2019, so this is pre-pandemic, the gap had widened to 3.3 billion via 153 billion. I mean, that is an enormous gap, Trevor. This is the crux of what you are currently dealing with, is it not?
Yeah, and I suppose that underpins our call for at this stage now a redistribution, or a time to look at a redistribution of the wealth within the game to protect the pyramid. You know, we've got 72 clubs that we're fighting for, who are suffering financially, and if we could get a fairer redistribution of the wealth within the game, then, as I say, that would lead to greater sustainability, would enable then clubs to attract more investors or more breadth of investors, would enable supporters, trusts themselves to get involved in the running of their clubs because they'd be able to afford it. So it all stems from balancing up, if you like, the finances within the game, which is why we're calling for the, you know, 25% of pooled revenues to be distributed to the EFL.
How worried are you about the future of the football pyramid, Trevor?
Well, it's survived for, you know, over 100 years now, Clem. So, and I think it will continue to survive, and it survives insolvencies of clubs as they're saved by the fans, by, you know, the local supporters trusts. So it will endure. I mean, what we're trying to do is give it a bit of a lift and a reset by seeking this redistribution. I think it will happen. I mean, how quickly it will happen, I'm not too sure, but hopefully the Tracy Crouch review results will lead to an impetus to change that, and in so doing should lead to greater sustainability for all clubs. So I am, you know, I'd like to think I'm confident that at some stage we are going to get a boost in revenues. But having said that, of course, it needs to be accompanied by proper cost control, and that additional revenue doesn't just run out of the game in terms of increased player wages.
Mm. Well, you've set that up beautifully for lots of further questions from me. I mean, first of all, Trevor, are you in dialogue with the Premier League about that distribution of funds? Is this a regular talking point when the two bodies get together?
Well, it's been mooted. I wouldn't say it's a regular talking point just at the moment. They're aware of our demand, Clem, and I think we're all just feeding into the Tracy Crouch review and waiting to see what transpires with her report. But yet we are, we have regular meetings and they're well aware of what our requirements or desires are.
I mean, playing devil's advocate, I think that was the deal that Rick Parry, in his role at the Premier League, offered the EFL, wasn't it, 27 years ago?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes, which didn't come to fruition, which is a shame. We might not be in the position we're in now, but yeah, I think Rick's been consistent in that. So hopefully at some stage that will be achieved.
Okay, so that's that one. We're talking about cost control. This is a big part of this. You know, you've tried to reduce and certainly bring the League One and Two clubs under salary cost management protocols. You did try hard salary wage caps, but they had to be withdrawn as a result of PFA intervention. I mean, how amenable to cost controls are clubs? And does it tend to depend upon the division, just how high up they are in your respective strata?
Yeah, I think all clubs are in support of it, Clem. I mean, why wouldn't you be? All clubs want to be sustainable and break even. So there is a huge desire to have some form of cost control. It's just the form that takes where the debate takes place. But certainly a majority are in favour of strong cost controls to enable them to, as I say, be sustainable.
I mean, just give us a little insight, because one of the great glories of the EFL, I think, is you have these diverse communities from Sunderland in the northeast, Carlisle in the northwest, right the way down to Plymouth in the southwest, right the way across to Gillingham in the southeast. There are so many different characteristics, type of clubs, types of owners. Is getting consensus difficult?
Well, I think you've probably answered your own question there, Clem.
Yeah.
That is the difficulty. You've got 72 clubs in the EFL, each with a different set of owners and constituents, from small community club to a big city club with a huge support and with a wide-ranging ownership group as well. So they will inevitably have different views as to what the structure, the financial regulatory framework should look like. Smaller clubs obviously want it to be an even playing field so that they can compete, and the bigger clubs want to spend more or less all they can to achieve success. So it's trying to attract a happy medium, which isn't always easy when you have to have consensus of the clubs.
Yeah. So when you're trying to introduce cost control, there is always the danger, I suppose,
correct,
that the bigger club in a division who can afford to spend that bit more or perceive themselves as being able to take a slightly bigger risk, it's hard to sort of shackle them and bring them into the herd, so to speak.
Yeah, so you I suppose you have to settle on some kind of proportionability to enable clubs to feel as if they are acting responsibly, and with those larger revenue streams can pay a higher share of that revenue on wages than a smaller club. So it's trying to achieve that proportionality.
Yeah, it's probably a good point for me to just remind anybody listening that the EFL is effectively, well, Trevor, it's like a trade association, isn't it? You are there to enforce the rules that are set and voted on by the clubs. So that's why we're just taking a little bit of time to just explain those kind of protocols there. I mean, you're not a body that stands in its own right. You are there to enforce the rules that the clubs set.
And therein potentially lies the conflict, of course, in that we are a trade organisation, but we're also there as a regulator as well, which I think we've done relatively successfully over the years. Obviously, some people will have some issues with certain events that have happened over the years, but generally, I think it's worked well. But it can lead to, you know, potential conflicts. If I were a commissioner, it would be a lot easier to say, right, these are the rules. This is what we're adhering to, or what you have to adhere to, and that's that. But unfortunately, you have to, you know, consensus has to be agreed. And for example, with financial regulations and the profit and sustainability rules, for example, then it's a two-thirds majority that have to vote on that for it to be implemented. So you have to get, you know, the consensus of the clubs agreed.
Every word that you speak, Trevor, is important, but I do think those ones, for anybody listening that doesn't understand those mechanics, this is not just you sitting in a back room going yay or nay. I think it's important that people understand that role as a trade body, as a trade association. Now, you mentioned the Tracy Crouch fan-led review into football governance. Where are we with that at the moment, and how significant do you think it's going to be for the future of clubs?
Okay, well, as with other organisations that Tracy's talking to, we've inputted into that. We've sat in front of the panel and provided our thoughts on the current state of affairs. I think she intends to have an interim report by the end of July, although that might change, and then a final report in October. So, you know, we're hoping, obviously, that if that results in a greater redistribution or a fairer redistribution of the wealth in the game for the EFL, Clem, then that will be a success.
And where could that lead ultimately? A more amenable model to fan-owned clubs, fans getting in involved in their football clubs, which a lot of people are obviously clamouring for that, Trevor, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think, like I have said before, I think the financial aspect of it is key, because unless clubs are sustainable, and to achieve that sustainability, you need two things. You need the greater revenue and you need cost control. If that is achieved and clubs then break even on a cash flow basis, it leads to a greater, or potentially greater, involvement of the fans in the running of their clubs. If you don't have that, and if you just have more involvement of the fans per se, then that really isn't going to achieve anything, because there's not a lot that they can do when the financial mechanics of the game are so distorted. And so it's key to unlocking greater fan ownership and involvement in the clubs.
Just while we're on the subject of wider football governance, EFL recently launched the Embargo Reporting Service. Do you just want to explain what that is about, Trevor, please?
Well, again, that's the league enforcing the regulations that have been voted on by the clubs. We have a series of regulations which are enforcing financial regulation, good practice in the way that the clubs are run, Clem, like filing accounts, paying other clubs, paying wages on time. And if clubs are in breach of those regulations, then one of the sanctions is an embargo on incurring further costs within the club. So it's trying to enforce good housekeeping and better financial regulation. So although it appears in harsh in stark headlines, you know, what we're trying to do is regulate the game and enable clubs to exercise good financial control.
And obviously the Embargo Reporting Service allows supporters to see who has been placed under restrictions, and it's a bit more transparency than just wondering what's going on at a certain football club, or maybe, you know.
Correct. The allegation has been, you know, all these things happen behind closed doors, and we don't know what's going on in the club, and why aren't they signing a player, etc., etc. So, you know, this is hopefully, you know, one of the steps that I'm taking in making the organisation a bit more transparent in the way that we deal with the clubs. So as long as it's open, it's consistent, I think that has to be the right way forward. Climate gives fans a greater understanding of what's happening within their clubs.
Just before we wrap things up, I do just want to talk to you about the EFL's two cup competitions. Just how significant are the Carabao Cup and Papa John's Trophy, Trevor, to the league and also to its clubs?
Yeah, hugely important. You know, I think we're the only European nation that has that second domestic major trophy. So Carabao Cup had for over 60 years. Clem is massively important to the league. The partnership with Carabao has just been extended until 2024. So, you know, it's a huge boost for the clubs. Generates probably around about 90 million of revenue for the league and the clubs in terms of broadcasting and sponsorship and match day revenue. So in that sense, it's a huge benefit to the league and to the clubs, culminating in a Wembley final, which is a great day out, and it's a breeding ground for young talent. Similarly, the Papa John's Trophy, Clem, it's another Wembley final, an exceptional prize for clubs in Leagues 1 and 2. Supporters seeing the club at Wembley for the first time. And a key principle of that competition was and remains to provide young English players with an opportunity to develop. And with prize pot of around 3 million, you know, it's a significant amount of prize money. I mean, in the England squad, for example, you have the likes of Reece James, Mason Mount, Bukayo Saka, Declan Rice, all making their professional debuts in those under-21 sides that play within the trophy. So it's played an important role in developing those young players. So both trophies, hugely important.
As we look ahead to the new season, is your glass half full or is it half empty, Trevor?
Oh, I think it definitely has to be half full, Clem. You know, as I say, on the back of the Euros, the back of the latent desire of all the fans to get back in the grounds and support their teams and shout and scream and interact socially, I think the future is bright.
Yeah, we await the Tracy Crouch fan-led review and her report, but would I be right in saying that your number one objective, apart from helping the clubs to get back on their feet in as safe a way as possible, is that sustainability of operating model? Is that the thing that is pretty much top of your to-do list most days?
I think it has to be, you know, as an accountant, I am going to say that, Clem, aren't I? But I think, you know, if it's not sustainable, then it just leads to instability and uncertainty. And, you know, without that stability of a financial model, then I think we're always going to be in this boom and bust cycle. So it has to be the number one priority to stabilise clubs, which then protects clubs for their community and provides a solid foundation for the future.
Trevor, always a pleasure. I'm sure you've got a spreadsheet to go back to, have you? You know, you need to take your socks off, start using your toes to count and all the things you accountants do. Great to talk to you, mate.
Thanks, Clem.
That's it for this edition of the official EFL podcast, looking at some of the inner workings of the EFL, its role, its functions, and its responsibilities. Thanks to Chief Executive Trevor Birch. Watch out for other episodes when we'll continue our unique insight into the key functions of the organisation. Until then, I'm Mark Clement. Thanks for listening to this mini-series edition of
the official EFL podcast.